Book bannings? Norway Nazi resistance? You want choice? We got choice right here. This is going to be a good one. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio. Fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
Betsy DeVos, the historian. Well, yeah, according to CBS, ABC, CNN, hell, probably even QVC, Betsy DeVos is now a historian. Who knew that one woman with no real work experience could not only serve as the Secretary of Education for the United States of America, but also do part-time work as a historian? I didn't, but it's true. Yeah, according to Betsy the historian, historically black colleges and universities have their origins in the, quote, choice movement. Yeah, you see, after the Civil War, freed slaves were unhappy with the educational opportunities, particularly colleges and particularly Southern colleges. Yes, Southern colleges obviously had a lot to be desired and were not in high demand with the newly freed slaves. They wanted better. What to do? Create your own colleges that provide opportunities needed by eager students with no choice for an education. That's right. Historically black colleges and universities came into being because of choice. Obviously, this is a load of crap that totally ignores that choice had nothing to do with the establishment of historically black colleges and universities. The fact was that Jim Crow era colleges legally practiced racial discrimination and denied African Americans entry to institutions of higher education. As Wade Henderson, president of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, suggested, the new secretary might want to, quote, study history of HBCUs, that's historically black colleges and universities, and, quote, check the facts. According to Wade, HBCUs were created in response to a racist system of segregation that saw the education of black people as a threat to white supremacy, a belief central to slavery, and that refused to allow black people to participate in the education system available only to white people. Whoops. Looks like Betsy might want to pivot, take a stab at writing fiction, because history obviously has her utterly perplexed. Arkansas to revive book banning. That's right, book banning. Representative Kim Hendren introduced legislation last week that would prohibit any publicly supported schools from including in curriculum or course materials any books or other material authored by Howard Zinn. That's right, no more Howard Zinn in Arkansas. Why, you ask? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? Because of his blatant disregard for authority and his unpatriotic prose that denies every American citizen the truth about American exceptionalism. Reading and teaching anything by Howard Zinn must stop if America is ever to be great again.
Wait a minute, Tim. What are you doing? What are you talking about? What? You're reporting this as if it's actual news? You're colluding with the devil.
Wait, is this...
This is Nancy. This is Matt Damon's mom, Nancy Carlson Page. Matt, we lived next door to Howard Zinn when he wrote The People's History, his most famous book. He gave it to us. I read the first chapter to Matt. He was 10. It changed his life.
We can tell it.
He took him to school and read it to his fifth grade. Anyway, that's a violation of the First Amendment. Censorship.
You know what? I knew there was a good reason why we had you on the show. Thank you for setting me straight, Nancy, Matt Damon's mom, Carlson Page. My goodness. How was I thinking this was good stuff? Thank
you. You've got to be careful these days when you read the news.
Okay,
because
well,
a lot of people are normalizing some pretty strange things.
Well, there's a lot of what they are calling alternative facts out there nowadays.
Yeah, that's right. And I was kind of hoping this was an alternative fact.
Oh.
Because this person, whoever it is, Kim Hendren, this representative, obviously doesn't know the Constitution.
Well, that's one of the first things I thought about when I saw it. I was like, okay, book banning. We're pretty sure that's outlawed, and the idea that publicly funded schools particularly are where we're not, you know, targeting specifically 95% of the American population who go to public schools. So in Arkansas, will be denied the right for any curricular materials, anything written by Howard Zinn. What's behind this, though, Nancy? Let's be real. Why attack Howard Zinn material? You just said he was your next-door neighbor. You read A People's History to Matt when he was 10. Matt obviously turned out all right, although Jimmy Kimmel doesn't like him that much. But
and I only read the first chapter because you should read A People's History. I read the entire book, and I hope everybody does. It's an amazing book that is told from the perspective of disenfranchised people. Feminists and laborers and enslaved people and anti-war activists. It's a remarkable history book, and it's all these firsthand accounts of what people experienced in history that's never been documented in one place before. It's an incredible book, but Howie wrote about 25 books, and he wrote 4 or 5 wonderful plays. So that's a lot of stuff to ban, for one thing. They're going to be very busy. And furthermore, there's the Zinn Education Project that I hope listeners know about, because it's wonderful curriculum materials based on Howard's work for middle school and high school. Thousands of teachers are accessing this material online these days and finding all kinds of creative ways to use it, even in this kind of restrictive ed reform environment.
Well, here's what I like, though. Did you see this part, though? Right now, if you live in Arkansas and you're a teacher, they're giving away A People's History of the United States to you if you're a teacher in Arkansas.
Who is?
I think it's the Zinn Education Project. I have to double check, but I,
you know what? So that is so funny, because if Howie were alive, he died in 2010. He would, he had the best sense of humor of anyone I've ever known in my life, but he would think this is funny.
Okay.
He would make a lot of jokes and say that this was a great endorsement of his books.
Right. Well, I mean, this is the best way to get a good, you know, to beef up sales is to have your book banned.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. But he would also, you know, on a more serious level, would understand that this is really a concern, and the fact that it's happening right now when we're seeing so many ultra-right-wing policy things getting enacted. It's frightening also.
Well, let's be honest. That's what this is. This is a fear of the information, and you know, not just Howard. Obviously, this whole idea that Howard brings up of these stories of, as you know, we said, laborers, slaves, indigenous peoples,
right,
telling that story as if those stories didn't happen. But there's a fear behind, obviously, Kim Hendren, the representative there, that if children learn this, they're somehow going to be disobedient, overthrow the government, or some kind of crazy thing. And maybe, I don't know, maybe he's right. Maybe that might not be a bad thing.
It's fear-based, and it goes against many of the assumptions that conservative people depend upon. For example, the Columbus story, the first chapter of A People's History of the United States starts out with the true story of Christopher Columbus, and that's what I read to Matt. Because kids had been told in school, you know, the fantasy story about the discovering America thing.
Right.
And that chapter is very real. It's accounts from the priest Las Casas, who kept journals, and it explains how Columbus cut off the hands of the Arawak Indians if they didn't bring him the gold that he sent them out to get, and many other cruelties that he enacted on the indigenous people that he enslaved. So it's very upsetting for a child or an adult or any thinking person to have their glamorized stories about how wonderful their country are be contradicted.
Well,
and that's why they don't want anybody to know about it.
It's you know, you said that, and then I've used the book, and I don't know how many times over the 20 years that I've been teaching social studies methods, and I've used that book with, you know, 19-year-olds to 27-year-olds, and the amount of times every semester that I would use that book where I would have students say, why didn't they teach us this? I did not know about this. Why was this information withheld from me? And that's kind of the other side of this, of denying people information that when they do find out, how upsetting it is. And that's the other part that I learned is that, you know, my students left empowered after being shown this, and were then very much against the idea of banning any type of information. You know,
because I think that fear-based assumption is that if people know a full story and know the truth, that you can't control them anymore.
But, well, I tell you what, there's no controlling Matt Damon's mom, because who knew that during my news that you were going to break in right then like that? My goodness.
Okay, you got to be a little more discerning about what news you read, seriously.
Well, I will take that as a lesson and never try to read the news as presented by certain people, because, as you said, we are in the world of alternative facts
and fake news. Just remember, I'll be listening.
Coming up after we talk resistance with Rivera's son, we'll hear from Denisha Jones, who actually works with Matt Damon's mom at Defending the Early Years. I wonder what Matt Damon's mom would think about us having Denisha on regularly.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Oh, I'd be completely supportive to have Denisha come on the show, and to come on the show as often as she could swing it. She's busy, but she would be a great person to talk about a lot of education issues. As I said, she knows a lot about policy, and I think that's why she was able to make this connection between how choices worked in early childhood and how it would work without doing a massive national experiment that's going to end up hurting a lot of kids and producing more inequality, which is what she's explaining in the blog. And that she would be, it would be wonderful to have her on and ask her about this issue and many other issues.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
Welcome to the show, author activist Rivera's son. You're a trainer in strategy for nonviolent movements. You're the co-host of Love and Revolution Radio. You're the author of several novels featuring nonviolent action, including The Dandelion Insurrection, The Way Between, and The Billionaire Buddha. You live in an earthship in New Mexico. Welcome to Busted Pencils.
Thanks for having me on the show. I'm delighted to be here.
So what is an earthship?
It's a style of architecture that uses passive solar windows facing south to heat it in the winter. Generally involves interesting angles and unusual shapes, and is totally sustainable and usually off-grid.
Oh, okay. Cool. Right off the bat, I would encourage people to go to Rivera's Son, that's RIVERASUN.com, just to get acquainted with all the stuff you're doing. And from your intro and the bio, people can get a sense of this. I want to go into a piece that you wrote in 2015 called Got Fascism, the 1942 Norwegian Teacher's Nonviolent Resistance to Nazis Has Answers. And this is a very interesting piece of history. Tell me a little bit about this idea. I mean, so Norway in the 40s, just acquainting everybody, World War II, Hitler, fascism, and teachers. What's going on?
Well, the Nazis invaded Norway in 1940, and in 1942, there was an attempt to implement a fascist curriculum in the schools led by a Norwegian collaborator with the Nazi Party, a guy named Quisling, who disbanded the existing teachers' union and required all the teachers to register with the new union. But the teachers opposed this because it was basically a fascist ideology that they did not agree with and was part of the attempt of the Nazi Party to take over their country. So between 8,000 to 10,000 of the 12,000 teachers in Norway responded to this by signing a letter refusing to cooperate in any way, shape, or form. And the government, the Quisling government, panicked and closed the schools for a month, sending the children home to their parents.
Now, that's always a good thing to do, is send kids home to their parents when parents think kids should be at school.
Yeah, they, you know, parents love that kind of thing. It makes it so easy to get to work.
Right. Now, so this backfired, right?
Totally.
Okay.
200,000 of the parents started protesting the government, and the teachers began to hold classes in secret in defiance of orders. These were the teachers teaching just basic Norway curriculum, not the fascist curriculum. Not the,
right. Okay. So the
right.
So they're teaching their old curriculum, the Norwegian curriculum. They're defying the mandate to teach a fascist curriculum.
Exactly. And so it's total chaos in Norway, right? And the government, the Quisling government, ordered the arrest of thousands of teachers and then ended up sending 500 of them to a prison camp. Now, when they tried to do that, as these train loads of teachers were going north, the students and the families actually gathered along the tracks singing to them and offering them food in through the bars of the cars and giving them warm clothing. And the teachers continued to strike and to refuse to work in the prison camp, and it went back and forth for quite some time. But by November 1942, the Quisling government had to confess that they couldn't control the situation, and they released all the teachers and abandoned their plans to implement a fascist curriculum. So this is such a key story for us right now, as many people are looking around and thinking, do we got fascism here in the United States? And there are many elements of this story that actually are very apropos to our situation.
How does it apply today? Whether, you know, now people might say, okay, you know, fascism, you're kind of pushing it and all that. I don't know. Maybe we are, maybe we're not. But the story of teacher resistance, what should I take from that?
Well, teachers, number one, are a bedrock of our society and our culture. They're critically important to the kind of people that we raise, train, educate, and ultimately become. They hold high respect, even if in the U.S. they hold generally low salaries compared to the respect that we actually hold for them. And right now, what we're looking at with the confirmation of Betsy DeVos into the Secretary of Education position is a number of things that people are concerned about. We are very much concerned about the privatization of the public schools, which has been on the DeVos agenda since the beginning. And this is very, very similar to the Norwegian situation, actually, right down to the attempt to take over the schools as a fascist corporation. One thing we can look at, and one thing we can really learn from the Norwegians, is that we don't have to go quietly along with these plans, that we really can oppose them very clearly, and that parents, teachers, and students can actually work together to create coordinated campaigns of resistance. If we feel like our public school is an asset to our community and should stay in our community, governed by our community in a democratic fashion, then we do have the right to resist a fairly undemocratic process of privatizing that school. Now, people say, is this real? But we need only look over to Detroit, Flint, Benton Harbor to see that the takeover of school boards and the takeover of schools is a very real lived experience in the United States under conditions that are highly undemocratic. We also have the privatization of schools in ways that are viewed more tolerantly or acceptably. Mm-hmm. But I think it was the National Association of Teachers penned an open letter to DeVos before her confirmation saying, we educate all children. We do not discriminate. We do not value the smart ones less than the ones that struggle or more than the ones that struggle. We teach them all. And that kind of commitment to the American child is the kind of thing that we as American people need to believe in. And so the Norwegians can teach us how to resist.
Can we resist? Well, yes. Look, it happened. It happened before. It happened in Norway in the 40s during the Nazi takeover of Norway. Teachers came together and resisted. You bring this story to us so that to remind us. But I, you know, as a historian and a teacher of history, one of the things that we try to say is that it's not just to remember some interesting story. It's to hopefully learn from it and motivate us to do something today. But how do we get to the collective resistance that you're talking about? Because I think what happens when people hear this story, and typically this is one of the faults that people have with telling history, is they tell it as if it's a story that happened back then that is out of touch and that we can't do, instead of realizing, no, the reason we tell it is that it's something that we should learn from and model. But as an individual, I feel like resisting Betsy DeVos and her nasty takeover and destruction of tons of Michigan schools, and now the possibility that she's going to try to do the same thing to all American schools, I feel alone, like I can't do it.
I think many people feel that way, and I think that breaking through that sense of isolation is one of the most powerful acts of resistance that we can take right now. We need to look around at our communities and start to connect with one another as a first step. We need to look at the organizations that we belong to, whether they're social organizations or unions or networks such as parent-teacher associations, and start having these conversations now. These networks and organizations and institutions are vitally important to the functioning of nonviolent struggle. It's something we see in this field that I've studied and teach in over and over and over again. Now, to give American teachers a lot of credit, they know this. Mm-hmm. A lot of them know and understand the importance of organized resistance, and we see it in the teachers' unions, but we also see it in the networks of support that they have developed and cultivated to try to maintain and improve our children's education under increasingly difficult circumstances of shrinking budgets. We've seen them really rally for different causes and purposes about protecting every child's right to an education. So I know this kind of organizing is not unfamiliar. It's been part of the legacy of the teachers of this country, and now we're facing new challenges. And so one of the things that we can each start doing in our own lives is opening up these conversations. You might be surprised by what your kid's teacher is thinking, by what your neighbor is thinking, by maybe even what your kid is thinking. People forget that all across this country, we had thousands of high school students walk out with United Opt Out, protesting the increasing and overburdening programs of standardized testing. So I think we need to understand the strength and the resilience that we have, and we need to start connecting to that. And then we need to tap into the coordinated resistances that are already growing and mobilizing. We are certainly not alone, and we can certainly find each other.
And let's bring it back, you know, and say, hey, it's happened before and it's been done successfully. This idea of resistance is really prevalent in history. Rivera-san, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Educated Educators Talking Education. Get the latest blogs from Peggy with a Pen, Lily's Pad, and Rebel Teacher now exclusively at BustedPencils.com. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
On the next episode of Busted Pencils, we will talk with Haley Braden from Denver's Caucus of Today's Teachers. Let's get warmed up for that interview by asking Haley that famous Alfie Cohn question. What are the schools our children deserve?
Well, it's interesting you should ask, because some of the founding members of our caucus were responsible for a whole campaign last spring, about a year ago, where in Denver we held several community meetings at different schools to ask parents, students, teachers, other community members what they believed their schools should be providing for their kids. And so parents, community members, teachers all came together to come up with these lists and discuss what are our schools doing well, what do we need to improve for the future. And what it came down to is schools should be not only places where children learn reading, writing, and math, but also community centers where the whole community feels like they have a stake in the school, whether they have kids in the school or not. So they're really beacons for the community and places where people come together to learn from each other, not just places where we give kids tests and homework.
Really looking forward to hearing more from Haley in 2 weeks on Busted Pencils. Texas Superintendent John Kuhn will join us on that episode as well. That's going to be a great one.
Unfiltered, comprehensive, and of course, controversial. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Welcome to Busted Pencils, Denisha Jones. Denisha is an assistant professor in the College of Arts and Sciences at Trinity Washington University in Washington, D.C. Now, bear with me. She's a former early childhood teacher and preschool director. She received a PhD from the Indiana University in 2013. She's in Badass Teachers, United Opt Out. She's also in law school. The question is, Denisha, how the hell did you have time to write a blog?
Very, very carefully. I had to be inspired by an idea and just kind of block out some time and get it done.
Okay, so let's go to it. So you're writing for Defending the Early Years, the DEYproject.org, and the blog title, What Early Childhood Education in the United States Can Teach Us About School Choice. Right in the title, that's really interesting, because it gets it at what we're talking about right now. We have Betsy DeVos, our new Secretary of Education, who is really extolling the virtues of choice. And we don't have a whole lot to go on. But you say, wait a minute, we do have someplace to look and look at the effects of choice on education, and that's early childhood. So what do we know?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about how to approach National School Choice Week. As you know, it happened in January. It happens every year. And, you know, one of the proponents of choice will say, well, why don't you just give us a chance to try this model out? We don't know. Because, you know, in the United States, still 80 to 85%, I think, of students are in traditional public schools. So even though we see an influx of charter and vouchers, it's nowhere near where they want it to be. So that's a valid argument. We don't know what choice can do because we don't try it. But then I started thinking, wait a minute, we know exactly what choice does because our early childhood system is a model of choice.
So that's good then, right? It's a model of choice. Like Betsy said, choice is out there. The early childhood system works perfectly as a choice-based system.
Well, actually, it doesn't. There's been a push in early childhood to actually get universal pre-K, right? That's what we want, kind of like the public school system, because what we learned in our, you know, over 50, 60 years of looking at the early childhood system is that choice means those with more money get the best quality and those with less money don't get the best quality, right? Parents who can afford to spend $15,000 to $25,000 a year on a preschool are going to make sure that their child are well prepared for kindergarten, first grade, and et cetera. But parents who can barely afford, you know, rent plus groceries and have to settle for, you know, preschool that's affordable for their means, they're not getting the best quality. And we know that quality matters in early childhood, but quality is largely dependent on how much you can pay. So we push for universal early childhood. We want, you know, preschool to be available to all children at no cost to their parents because we know that would even the system out.
Well, no, but isn't Head Start doing that? Hasn't Head Start fixed the problem with inequitable, you know, child care access?
I mean, Head Start makes a dent. It's a federally funded program, but it's only limited to parents of a certain threshold. So if you are working poor family, meaning you work, you have two parents who work, but you're not, you know, you're working maybe $10, $12, $15 an hour, you know, you make too much money to qualify for Head Start. So we do know that in many states, if you look at the studies of how many 3- and 4-year-olds there are in the area, and how there's a large number who aren't covered by Head Start and aren't, if they don't have public funded pre-K programs, then they're just not in programs, or they're in private programs based on the amount their parents can pay. And as a former kindergarten teacher, you know, we know the children who come in who haven't had real quality experiences beforehand. That's where the start of the gap in academic achievement, right? It starts at kindergarten when you see a child who comes in and can identify all 26 letters, uppercase and lowercase, all colors, can count to 10, and a child who's still trying to figure out, you know, just how to say basic things, right? They haven't learned any of that. That's the gap. It starts right there.
So do you have anecdotal and or is there research out there that says, look, when kids get to kindergarten, their childcare setting has a definite observable effect on their performance in kindergarten. And you, as your kindergarten teacher, absolutely, you're definitely seeing that. Do we have research out there that says the same thing?
There is research out there. I did cite in my blog for DEY, I did cite a study that looked at quality. They took some data and looked at quality early childhood outcomes. I think the problem with the research that's out there, and I can find, I'm trying to pull up the link to it so I can speak more directly to that study. I think the National Child Institute of Health did a long study, and they have data that people look for. And then, of course, the National Association for the Education of Young Children, who I link to, they talk about some of the research on quality. I think the problem with the research, though, is that they're looking for gains to last past a certain couple of years, and mm-hmm. those studies end up coming up short. So we typically don't see the gains in early childhood lasting past second grade, and so people then say early childhood is not important, but we know lifelong outcomes, right, that the more we invest in early childhood, the less we have to invest in juvenile detention and prison and those other type of factors. So there is some type of connection. I think the reason why the gains might not last through first or second grade is just that there are different factors happening once a child's in those grades, right, that their early childhood time can't account for in a longitudinal research study. But the reality is any kindergarten teacher will tell you that they can see the difference of a child who's coming from a high-quality program or, you know, with a nanny or a parent who is, you know, giving that kind of high-quality one-on-one care, the difference that makes in that first year and that second year of being in school, right? They're more prepared. They're easier to make the transition. There's a lot of research on kindergarten readiness, right? Mm-hmm. And whether children are ready for kindergarten. And I think a lot of those studies show that children who did attend a high-quality preschool are more likely to do well in kindergarten and have those kindergarten readiness skills.
You know, what's interesting is what you just talked about, though, that kind of evening off. I remember having a, let's just call it a discussion, with somebody who was trying to tell me that Head Start didn't matter because Head Start kids, by the time they get to third grade, don't have an advantage and are reading at grade level when they get to third grade. And if Head Start really worked, they would be above grade level and fifth grade and accelerated. And I looked at him and I said, are you kidding me? You just actually said that the problem with Head Start is that by third grade, kids are reading at grade level.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, there's different studies with the Head Start. I recently was on a webinar listening to folks really upset about a study that came out of Tennessee, and I can't be sure if it was Head Start, but it was definitely early childhood. And they were just saying that, you know, the gains were not there in first and second grade when they measured these students. And again, I think that's a little disingenuous to then say, well, Head Start or preschool is not valuable. You know, just because the gains don't last doesn't mean that what that child experienced in those years isn't important, right? And I don't think the research can accurately measure that. So there's definitely other things that we have to look at. And I was a product of Head Start. I'm also a product of other federally funded programs that help low-income and minority children, and I'm a successful academic researcher scholar because of those things, right? So you can talk anecdotally about it, or you can let data that often can't really capture what we know to be true, and that children who have a good, high-quality early childhood experience are going to do better off in school, right? They're just going to have that better start. Whether it lasts through third or fourth grade, that doesn't mean they don't develop reading problems down the line. Just because you went to preschool doesn't mean you might not have dyslexia or other issues, right, that might affect your ability to keep that up. But it's still a better experience than children not having it. But again, under a choice model like we have now, where you can go to a private religious program, you can go to a nonprofit program, a for-profit program, family daycare home providers, which are licensed in variable ways in different states, right? There's so many options out there, but it's all based on how much money you can spend.
There's so much to talk about here. There's so much in this blog. And, you know, I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. So the Busted Pencils show, we have Matt Damon's mom as a regular person who comes on this show. She's an early childhood educator, Dr. Nancy Carlson Page. And Denisha Jones is an early childhood educator. And I'm thinking, you know, it would be great if I could get the two of you together for an extended interview about this issue and how choice in the early childhood system can help us understand what choice might look like in the public system. What do you say?
I think that would be great. I love Nancy, and I definitely would like to, I know we've been emailing back and forth. She loved the topic for the blog, so I know she has some thoughts about, you know, and I'd love to hear her take on it as well, because I think there's a lot more, like you said, to be said about this topic, right? Because even the push for universal pre-K, we're learning now, those of us who want that are also learning that that comes with a set of strings that we might not want, right? That comes with developmentally inappropriate standards for young children. That comes with more testing at an early age. So, yeah, the choice system has some concerns, but so does universal system. So how do we negotiate between both of those? I think that'd be a great conversation to have with Nancy and Busted Pencils.
Denisha, as always, thanks for Busting Pencils.
Thank you.
Educated educators talking education. Get the latest blogs from Peggy with a Pen, Lily's Pad, and Rebel Teacher now exclusively at BustedPencils.com. This is Busted Pencils Radio.
Matt's mom talked about reading Howard Zinn to her son when he was little, so it's only fitting that Matt handle our weekly tribute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. Here is your moment of Zen.
And our topic is topsy-turvy, civil disobedience. Now, as soon as you say the topic is civil disobedience, you're saying our problem is civil disobedience. That is not our problem. Our problem is civil obedience. Our problem is the numbers of people all over the world who have obeyed the dictates of the leaders of their government and have gone to war. And millions have been killed because of this obedience. We recognize this for Nazi Germany. We know that the problem there was obedience, that the people obeyed Hitler. People obeyed. That was wrong. They should have challenged, and they should have resisted. And if we were only there, we would have showed them.
My thanks to Rivera's son, Denisha Jones, and of course, Matt Damon's mom. Making a rare double appearance this week, I'm Tim Slecker. Keep busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.